And my task is to introduce the speaker and make a few preliminary observations and announcements. Amongst those observations and announcements, let me remind you initially of the pleasures that are to come to you on future Saturday evenings. That is, if you come to the Vancouver Institute. Next week, on March the 4th, Dr. John Ford of the Vancouver Aquarium will speak on, quote, Killer Societies, the Natural History and Culture of Killer Whales. Among his other accomplishments, Dr. Ford discovered a remarkable system of vocal dialects in killer whale communication. The following week, on March the 11th, Dr. Angus Reid will deliver the Vancouver Sun Lecture on the future of Canada and Quebec. Dr. Reid, as you know, is one of North America's most distinguished and well-known pollsters. On March the 18th, the novelist Audrey Thomas, one of Canada's best-known writers, will be with us for, as the brochure says, an evening with Audrey Thomas. And finally, we have three Saturday nights to wind up our sessions and our season, and they feature Jeffrey Simpson, Connor Cruz O'Brien, and Roger Penrose. Now, early next week, the Honorable Paul Martin will inform us that there are no more free lunches. In fact, he will probably tell us that some of what we thought of as free lunches, which we've already eaten, now have to be paid for. What has this to do with the Vancouver Institute, you are wondering? Well, it has three things to do with the Vancouver Institute. Firstly, in some sense, I think we are witnessing the retreat of the state, and therefore the private voluntary sector is called on to play a greater role in our public existence. And one of those private voluntary institutions is the Vancouver Institute. Secondly, the fact that the Honorable Paul Martin will ask us to pay both for the past as well as for the future, this allows me to say that although our season is well advanced, I can still ask you to give your financial support for the lectures you have heard, as Mr. Martin will for the services you have received, as well as for those lectures that are yet to come. And thirdly, when you pay your taxes to Mr. Martin, not personally, of course, but as a representative of the state, when you pay your taxes to him, it is a civic duty, but one backed by the coercive power of the state. When you join the Vancouver Institute, you perform a purer, nobler, more altruistic act. Such a voluntary response to the twinges of your conscience is the real test of your citizenship. Besides, our fees and donations are tax deductible, which seems a little contradictory to what I've been saying, as we are contributing to the deficit of the state, but our fees also are not exorbitant. In fact, I have heard no one describe a membership fee of $5 per student, $15 for a single individual, and $25 for a family as outrageous. In fact, if anybody did describe them as outrageous, I would describe that comment as outrageous. So, if you have not already done so, please join as you leave. You can do so by leaving on the right, and there is a table out there, and someone will be there to graciously take your money or your check, and you will reduce your income taxes for the coming year. Now to our speaker. Robin Bodway is Sir Edward Peacock Professor of Economic Theory at Queen's University, where he has taught for 20 years. His career is heavily sprinkled with honors. After I wrote that, I wasn't clear whether heavily and sprinkled were somewhat contradictory. Sprinkling sounded light, but anyway, it is heavily sprinkled with honors. He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. He is a Fellow of the Royal Society. He was editor of the Canadian Journal of Economics for 6 years. He was head of the Queen's Department of Economics, and he is at the moment vice president of the Canadian Economics Association, and you will see him, when you see him, you'll be struck by his youthfulness. His research and publications concentrate on public sector economics and welfare economics, with special emphasis on tax policy, fiscal federalism, and cost-benefit analysis. He is in heavy demand, as indicated by research undertaken for the World Bank, the Economic Council of Canada, and at least 3 royal commissions. Tonight he will speak to us on the subject, Reforming Social Policy, Can the Federal Government Deliver? This lecture is the E.S. Woodward Lecture, the E.S. Woodward Foundation, being the body that has made Dr. Bodway's visit to us possible. So let me introduce Dr. Robin Bodway to address us this evening.
Thank you very much, Professor Cairns. Now, this seems to me to be a very nice idea for an institution to bring together members of the university and members of the community. Those of us in the university who have the luxury to be paid to sit and think about issues that are of interest to the community rarely get an opportunity to communicate with you. At least where I come from, and I think it's very very nice indeed, and I very much welcome the opportunity to do so, and am very grateful for having been invited to come here. The topic that I have chosen to address you on is one that I think is of considerable interest to the community at large, and that has to do with the reform of social policy and the role of the federal government in that process. For evidence that this may be of some interest to the community, I refer you to this morning's edition of the Globe and Mail, which reports the results of a rather extensive survey of Canadians on their attitude towards government. And I found the article to be quite informative and a little bit surprising. What is clear from that survey is that average Canadians feel quite strongly that governments have an indispensable role to play in the achievement of social justice. Those were the words that were used. However, they also think at the same time that governments are not delivering. There's obviously much scope for reform. And my purpose is to make some remarks about the role of the federal government in particular in that process. Let me begin by stating what this talk is not about. First of all, lest you got the wrong impression from the title, which was negotiated over a long period of time and came out quite differently than it went in. It's not about the appropriate design of social programs. That is, it's not about how the unemployment insurance system should be reformed, whether it should be a two-tiered system, whether it should have a training component, whether it should include income assistance, and so on. Nor is it about how the welfare system should be changed to take into account problems of the working poor or child poverty. It's not about whether public pensions should be targeted to those in need or whether they should be funded according to actuarial principles. Nor am I going to talk about whether the state should have a role in the delivery and the financing of child care, or about whether principles of pricing and private provision should be applied to health care, or indeed whether students should bear a greater burden of the costs of post-secondary education. These are all very, very important issues. I'm going to take one step back and really ask about the nature of decision-making over social policy issues in a federation such as Canada's, which is a highly decentralized one by international standards. As the title suggests, I'm going to ask, can the federal government deliver, rather than what can the federal government deliver or what should the federal government deliver? It's really about the way in which the responsibility for achieving social policy objectives is divided between and shared by the federal and the provincial levels of government, and how this might be reflected in the policy instruments that we make available to those governments. Now, obviously, this is not unrelated to questions of social program design and policy reform. Indeed, one of the themes of my talk is that social policy reform can be greatly constrained by a failure of the federal system to condone policy instruments that are commensurate with responsibilities by the two levels of government. Now, I'm an economist by training, who takes a relatively formal approach like all economists do, to issues. And we tend to look at things in a sort of a syllogistic fashion, if this, then that. And so I thought maybe I should just begin by summarizing the thesis of my presentation in a simple syllogistic line of reasoning, beginning with the premise, a major premise. Suppose we take it as a premise that the federal government has a legitimate role to play in pursuing national standards of redistribution, redistributive equity, or social justice. I'll use these terms interchangeably. What follows from that for social policy reform in our federation? I'm not going to answer the question of whether I think that that premise is reasonable or not. If you think it's reasonable, I'm going to argue that certain consequences follow from that. If you don't think it's reasonable, then other consequences follow from it. Social policies are the vehicles for achieving redistributive equity. They include a wide variety of policies and comprise, I will argue, much of what governments do. Some of these social policy instruments are federal, such as the unemployment insurance system, pensions. Some of them are jointly delivered, such as the tax transfer system. Others are exclusive provincial responsibilities, such as health, education, and welfare, especially those social programs that are most critical for achieving goals of redistributive equity. While there are very good economic reasons for decentralizing the design, delivery, and financing of social programs, such decentralization can lead to violations of national equity and efficiency norms for a variety of reasons. Lack of coordination among policy instruments and among provinces can lead to inefficiencies in the operation of the national economy. Competitive beggar thy neighbor policies of provinces can lead to adverse redistributive consequences, referred to sometimes as the race to the bottom. Fiscal decentralization can lead to fiscal or horizontal inequities among provinces and to inconsistent standards of vertical equities in different regions. For these and other reasons, the system of federal-provincial fiscal arrangements between the federal government and the provinces is an integral part of the social policy arsenal of the federal government. Indeed, it is, I would say, the major source of federal influence, given the division of responsibilities that exists. The system of federal-provincial fiscal relations has served us very well in the past. However, given the extent and the nature of decentralization that has taken place, the continuing ability of the federal government to achieve its social policy objectives are on the verge of being seriously compromised. The fiscal foundations of the Federation are very fragile. Federal policies in the next few years can undo in an irreversible way, I think, the benefits that we've largely taken for granted from our federal system. And thus, I think we're at a fairly critical juncture. The question that I want to address is, should we worry about that? And if so, what, if anything, could we do about it? And whether we should worry about it or not depends upon whether you accept the major premise, which is that the federal government has some responsibility for national norms of social justice. What I'm going to suggest is that while the provinces have primary responsibility for the design and delivery of most important social programs, the federal government can be viewed as having a legitimate role to play in coordinating social policy, in establishing minimum national standards and financing social policy, a role which is based both on reasonable economic argumentation and is sanctioned also by the Constitution. And what I'm going to argue is that federal-provincial fiscal relations, in the broadest sense, form the basis for the federal role in social policy. The gradual decentralization of fiscal responsibilities in Canada over the past 25 years has reached the point where the ability of the federal government to fulfill any role it may have in the social policy area, or even achieve the minimal reform set out in the recent Axworthy Green Paper — I wrote this before it was apparent that it was going to be in its demise — is in jeopardy. We must now decide, perhaps as soon as this budget or the budget to come next year, whether we want the federal government to retain that role. And as I said, I think that depends really on whether you accept the major premise that I listed earlier. My only fear is that the issue has not really been given proper attention. And what this represents is, I guess, an attempt to contribute to that debate. Let me begin, then. That's a sort of a bit of a summary of some of the things I'm going to be talking about. Let me begin with a statement about what social policy is. Since we're talking about social policy reform, I ought to be clear about what social policy means to me. To me, social policy is a synonym for redistributive policies, or policies for social justice, as the article in the Globe and Mail this morning referred to it as. Policies whose objective is to address equity or social justice in all of its dimensions. It involves both fostering greater equalities of opportunities, where that's appropriate, as well as greater equalities in outcomes or well-beings. Its components include a wide variety of things. Income-based redistribution operating through the tax transfer system, transfers to individuals delivered outside the income tax system, such as those to the elderly and to the poor. Social insurance schemes that are intended to compensate for various forms of misfortune that for various reasons are not insurable privately, such as unemployment, injury and disability, various forms of illness, even uncertainty in the payoff to higher education, as was recognized in the Green Paper. Public services are, in my view, a component of social policy as well. Public services, most of which are essentially private in nature to an economist, could be provided through the private sector, but are typically provided through the public sector, largely for redistributive reasons. Things like education, healthcare, public housing, daycare have a large redistributive component in them, or a large social equity component in them. And finally, the last component of social policy would be intergovernmental redistributive transfers, such as our equalization system. I think what economists are coming now to realize increasingly is that, first of all, redistributive policy is multifaceted, includes all of the list of things that I just pointed out. Secondly, that much of what governments do is redistributive in nature. And thirdly, that much of that redistribution is accomplished through the expenditure side of the budget rather than through the tax side. The fact that redistributive or social policy is seen to consist of so many components makes policymaking very difficult for several reasons. Policy coordination becomes important for the success of the overall package, and this is made more difficult when the policies are delivered at various levels of government. The assignment of responsibilities for redistributive policy in a federation is not easy. Virtually every policy that governments undertake have serious redistributive consequences. Ultimately, the responsibility will be shared necessarily between the levels of government. Different instruments of redistributive policy on the expenditure side may have been assigned to different levels of government. And most importantly, given that many of the most important instruments for redistribution are in areas of exclusive provincial legislative responsibility, if we accept our premise that the federal government bears some responsibility for social justice, the fiscal arrangements become indispensable for achieving national objectives. Let me talk a little bit about the roles of the federal and the provincial governments, respectively, in social policy formation. Many, but certainly not all, economists have argued that the federal government ought to have an overriding interest in redistributive equity on the grounds that citizenship in a country should entitle everyone to have the same weight in society's social welfare ordering, regardless of where they might reside. This objective would have a vertical dimension to it as well as a horizontal dimension. The vertical dimension would involve norms of redistribution from the better off to the less well off, where the relative sense of well-being depends not only on ability to pay in the sense of income or wealth, but also other indices of well-being such as health status, disability, employment status. Vertical equity also includes the notion of equality of opportunity. Horizontal equity involves seeing that otherwise equal citizens should be treated equally by the public sector broadly defined, federal and provincial, regardless of where they might reside. At the same time, there are very strong and widely accepted and I think fairly convincing economic reasons for wanting to decentralize the design and delivery of public services that serve individual citizens. Even if these functions were centralized, they would ultimately have to be decentralized administratively to deliver them at the citizen level. Because they are closer to those being served, it's felt that provincial governments are more responsive to local preferences and needs, are more politically accountable, more likely to be cost effective, and more likely to innovate. But purely provincially designed programs can lead to a patchwork of programs that violate national standards of equity and also introduce distortions into the national economy. For example, provinces might impose residency requirements, just like countries do, on access to their public services. They might compete with one another to attract higher income residents and to discourage lower income residents from living in their jurisdiction. They might have widely different capabilities to provide public services to their citizens. Given that the provision of public services represents one of the major ways in which objectives of social policy are achieved, the federal government has at least an interest in ensuring that public services provided by the provinces contribute to national equity objectives and do not violate efficiency across the national economy. Part of the role of the fiscal arrangements is to facilitate the harmonious coexistence of decentralized decision-making, which is very, very important to economists, while at the same time allowing the federal government to pursue its national equity and efficiency objectives or responsibilities. Now, interestingly, this sort of view of the world, this economic view of the world, is supported or at least condoned by the Canadian Constitution, something that many people are not aware of. For the purposes of social policy, the most important features of the Canadian Constitution are the following ones. Provinces are given exclusive legislative authority, responsibility, for programs in areas such as health, education, and welfare. The only major public service that's an exception to this, well, two of them, I suppose, would be unemployment insurance and pensions. Most importantly, for the purposes of the major premise that I laid out earlier on, is a section referred to as Section 36 in the Constitution Act of 1982, the act that is best known for repatriating the Constitution and introducing the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It included a Section 36 whose first part clearly states that both levels of government are jointly committed to at least part of the national equity agenda, i.e., providing equal opportunities for Canadians, reducing disparities, and providing essential public services. This provides support to the federal government's, to the major premise, to the view that the federal government has an interest in the delivery of public services that are essential or that serve to equalize opportunities and reduce inequalities. The second part of that Section 36 is equally as important. It commits the federal government to the principle of making equalization payments to ensure that all provinces can provide reasonably comparable public services at reasonably comparable tax rates. This can be viewed as a commitment to national horizontal equity, that is, to the principle that identical persons should be treated comparably by the public sector as a whole, regardless of where they choose to reside. Not to say that the provinces have to provide exactly the same public services at exactly the same tax rates, only that they could choose to do so, that they should have the resources to choose to do so if they so desired. Yet another important part of the Constitution, which predates the 1982 amendments, concerns the idea of the federal spending power, which is, to my mind, a key component of the federal policy arsenal. The ability to appropriate funds from consolidated general revenues for the public purpose is the basis of about two-thirds of the federal budget that consists of transfers. Everything except the goods and services expenditures. And the spending power enables the federal government to make transfers to the provinces conditional on the way in which provinces spend the monies, even though the spending is in areas of exclusive provincial jurisdiction. The federal spending power, in this sense, is what reconciles the joint federal-provincial responsibility for achieving vertical equity through the provision of public services with exclusive provincial responsibility in those areas. So those are very, to me, very key aspects of the Constitution which at least condone the view that the federal government has some role to play in social justice or national equity or whatever I choose to call it in one sentence as opposed to another. Thus, we have some support for the notion that the federal government can assume responsibilities for objectives of national nature, including national equity objectives. At the same time, the federal government does not have direct access to all of the policy instruments necessary to achieve national equity. Quite reasonably, the responsibility for providing most public services that serve redistributive ends are the exclusive responsibility of the provinces, as I've already mentioned. And this poses an important dilemma for the federal government. How can it begin to achieve its social policy objectives when many of the instruments for doing so are in the hands of the provinces? And the answer is clear. At least it seems to me to be clear. It can only do so with the use of the spending power. Otherwise, a national social policy is out of reach, and one must rely entirely on the provinces to accomplish social policy objectives, either individually or by some cooperative arrangement. So what becomes critical in evaluating the fiscal arrangements as instruments for social policy reform is ensuring that the scope of the spending power is sufficient for achieving national objectives. It seems to me to be as simple as that. Now, I know to many people the words spending power are four-letter words. And you may want to address that issue in the discussion later on. This view that the role of the spending power as an instrument of federal policy to achieve national objectives is an important one seems not to be widely understood. Let me give you some recent examples. First of all, the Axworthy Green Paper laying out federal policies for social policy reform neither mentioned the spending power nor recognized that most of the reforms mentioned in the Green Paper could not be achieved without it. Almost all of the reforms could not be achieved without it. Secondly, the last round of constitutional negotiations, culminating in the Charlottetown Accord and I guess beginning in the federal proposals, reaffirmed the role of national standards as an objective of federal policy, but at the same time, basically would have gutted the spending power as an instrument of policy. To me, this is contradictory. Third, Andrew Coyne, a well-known and thoughtful economic columnist with the Globe and Mail that some of you might be familiar with, recently wrote a persuasive article arguing strenuously for the importance of national standards in social programs. Sometime earlier, he had written a longer column explaining where expenditure cuts could be found in the federal budget to reduce the deficit to a very small amount. Not surprisingly, given that they constitute one quarter of federal program spending, he found substantial cuts in reductions in federal transfers to the provinces, without which the spending power that is necessary to achieve the national standards that he advocates could not be used. Fourth, I happened to read the Globe and Mail just quite a bit this morning, as you'll see. And perusing the letter column of the Globe and Mail, there was a letter from a person named Trevor Hodge from Ottawa, who writes letters to the Globe and Mail fairly frequently. I think he's a classicist. I'm not absolutely sure. What it said is, quote, "So the provinces are afraid that Finance Minister Paul Martin will dump some of the federal costs and expenses onto them. What's wrong with that? For as long as I can remember, the provinces have been demanding more power, and power also brings responsibilities. It's only fair that more power means more pay. In the very long run, I can't see that it makes much difference. Whether Canada pays or Ontario pays, the money still comes out of the same pockets, ours." Well, I think that fundamentally misconceives the role of the importance of the spending power and the role of the federal government in achieving its objectives. Oops. The relevant components of the spending power for the purposes of achieving national social policy consist of the transfers made from the federal government to the provinces, which together comprise, as I mentioned, about a quarter of federal program spending. The main such components are three. It's a very simple system in principle. Equalization payments from Ottawa to the seven have-not provinces. I apologize if I don't mention the territories here. I could do so, but I'll just talk about provinces. The second one is established program financing, or EPF, transfers in support of health and post-secondary education. The third one, Canada Assistance Plan CAP transfers that have matched provincial expenditures on welfare programs. All of these programs have been in place for a very long time. Equalization and CAP since the early 60s in their present form, middle 60s for CAP. EPF since 1977. Structures have changed very little, despite some fairly significant and, I would argue, largely irreversible changes that have occurred in the fiscal relationship between the federal government and the provinces, including the following. Rapidly growing provincial expenditure responsibilities. Provincial expenditure responsibilities roughly doubled as a percentage of GDP in the 30 years leading up to the beginning of the 1990s. Combined with the surprisingly stagnant growth of federal expenditures as a percentage of GDP, federal program expenditures as a percentage of GDP rose relatively little in the past 25 years. Quite a startling fact to me. The provinces have long since overtaken the federal government in terms of the magnitude of their program expenditures, and especially in terms of the magnitude of their expenditures on goods and services. At the same time, provincial reliance on their own source revenues has increased rapidly. Or as public finance economists would say, the vertical fiscal gap has grown smaller and smaller. This is partly because of the growth in provincial spending, partly because of the fact that federal transfers to the provinces are based on formulas that escalate much less than provincial expenditure responsibilities, and partly because with increasing frequency, the federal government has unilaterally reduced transfers to the provinces for purely fiscal reasons that have little concern, I think, for the longer-run consequences of these policies for the Federation. The consequence of this is the federal government is left with less leverage to use for it to use the spending power to achieve national objectives. There are greater disparities in the fiscal capacities across provinces as a result of this decentralization, and then therefore greater pressure is put on the equalization system to bring the have-not provinces up to national standards. And importantly, there's greater balkanization of the federation as provinces become more and more important as occupiers of income tax room. Moreover, these changes are largely irreversible. Once fiscal responsibilities are turned over to the provinces, it's very difficult to recapture it. It's very difficult to undo tax room that has been turned over from the federal government to the provinces. I think there's increasing evidence that this gradual decentralization is being increasingly accompanied by strains within the Federation. Policies being undertaken by different levels of government are in conflict. The federal government, it is well known, tends to use the unemployment insurance system as an income assistance program more and more, it being the main social policy instrument that the federal government has directly at its disposal. The provinces, for their part, systematically undertake policies which exploit the unemployment insurance system in ways which are fairly well known. Provinces engage in forms of interprovincial competition that have beggar thy neighbor aspects to them, bidding for industry away from other provinces, tinkering with welfare systems, restricting access to post-secondary education programs for out-of-province students, and so on. These sorts of practices seem, by a casual observation, to be increasing. The tax system itself, the Canadian income tax system, which has been highly harmonized by standards of federations since the end of the Second World War, has become increasingly fragmented as provinces implement ever-increasing amounts of exemptions, special incentives, special tax bases, tax holidays, and so on. At the same time, concern escalates over the federal tendency to act unilaterally and without notice to the provinces. Upper limits are put on EPF transfers to the provinces, and as well on equalization, and as well on the Canada Assistance Plan. In some cases, selectively imposed on certain provinces without warning, throwing provincial budgets into havoc. Tax changes are introduced by the federal government that automatically apply to the provinces. This tendency to make unilateral decisions at the federal level behind the veil of budget secrecy becomes less and less defensible the more decentralized the Federation becomes. In short, the Federation is becoming increasingly balkanized as it becomes increasingly more decentralized. Now, that may or may not be a bad thing or a good thing, but it is happening with scant regard being given to the longer-term consequences for the Federation, especially the increasing inability to use the spending power to encourage national standards. Should we care about this? Well, I guess that depends on whether you accept the major premise that I set out at the beginning, that the federal government has a legitimate role to play, as stated in the Constitution, in pursuing national standards of redistributive equity or social justice. If you don't take that as being a premise, you will be content to let events take their course, apart from the fact that you may dislike some of the efficiency consequences that arise from decentralization. To understand what it means to let events take their course, we must understand the key features of the three major transfer programs, equalization, EPF, and CAP. These are not difficult things to understand, and many of you will already be familiar with them, but let me just make a couple of simple remarks about each of them to explain to you what the key issues are. Equalization payments are made each year to the seven have-not provinces. Well, there happen to be seven have-not provinces. There could be as many have-not provinces as there are have-not provinces. But at the moment, there are seven. Their intent is to make up the difference between the ability of the have-not provinces to raise revenues and that of the national average, or some definition of the national average. This accords precisely with the constitutional commitment, the principle laid out in Section 36. The program has, by most people's agreement, been strikingly successful at doing that, at raising the tax capacities of the have-not provinces to the national average. The revenue-raising ability of the have-not provinces has been calculated to be at somewhere between 95 and 98% for most recent years of the national average. However, the federal government has imposed a cap on the growth rate of equalization. It cannot grow more rapidly than GDP. This cap is now binding and will become more so as time goes by and as the Federation is more decentralized. Thus, the ability of the federal government to meet the constitutional equalization objective, which I take to be part of the social policy objective, will fall. The EPF program is the one that is suitable for achieving the spending power objectives. The equalization program is not very apt for spending policy objectives because it doesn't apply in all provinces. Nominally, the EPF is an equal per capita transfer to all provinces that is supposed to escalate at the rate of growth of GDP. All provinces are supposed to get an equal per capita amount. However, owing to what I would call a quirk in its design in 1977, the actual amount of cash transferred under the EPF program is gradually declining and will run out entirely sometime, depending on how fast the economy grows, sometime early in the next century. Much earlier for Quebec. It's this cash transfer which enables the federal government to set national health standards and to enforce them with the possibility of financial penalties. Penalties which have not had to be resorted to very much, as it turns out. Now, this quirk which causes the cash balances to decline, the cash transfer to decline, arises because the full transfer to each province includes the value of the tax room, a little technical here, that was transferred from the federal government to the provinces in 1977, and quite remarkably, is still calculated and counted against the full transfer and treated as part of the transfer that the federal government is making to the provinces. Because the value of this tax transfer is growing more rapidly than GDP, i.e. growing more rapidly than EPF full grant itself, the cash component that makes up the full transfer is declining. And its decline is accelerated by periodic restrictions on the rate of growth of EPF, such as the one that is currently in place. Once the cash component runs out, the leverage available to the federal government to influence national standards in health and post-secondary education will be gone. The third major program, the Canada Assistance Plan, CAP, is supposed to be a grant that matches each province's expenditures on welfare programs with federal funds. It, too, is conditional on provincial welfare programs complying with certain national standards. The matching aspect itself has been subject to much criticism because it is said to induce provinces to overexpand their spending on welfare programs and to cause costs to escalate more rapidly than for the federal government than they otherwise would. The federal government has responded to this concern and to its general fiscal problems by imposing caps on the cap transfer, what's referred to as the cap on cap, but only imposing them on the three have provinces, Alberta, British Columbia, and Ontario. And this has certainly caused some havoc in these provinces. It's long been advocated since the early 1970s that the Canada Assistance Plan be turned from a matching grant scheme into a block grant scheme like the EPF program. That is a scheme that does not depend on actual provincial spending for the amount that's transferred to a province. Such a grant could be conditional on national standards being met, just like the EPF transfer for health is conditional on criteria set out in the Canada Health Act being met. Now, letting events take their course, which is the option that I suggested you might prefer if you didn't abide my major premise, would entail keeping the cap on equalization, letting the EPF cash transfer run down naturally, perhaps converting the cap grant fully to a block grant so it doesn't escalate as rapidly as it's doing, possibly aggregating it with the EPF program, as has been suggested, and letting them both run down, and perhaps even accelerating the decline in EPF and CAP transfers even further by using them as instruments for federal deficit reduction. The consequence would quite simply be a gradual elimination of the federal government to use the spending power to implement national standards and social programs and to achieve the equalization principle as stated in the Constitution. The Federation would become more balkanized and social policy would essentially be a provincial matter. And for all intents and purposes, these changes would be very difficult to reverse. If you do care about the federal government maintaining a role in social policy, or even if you're not sure and you'd like to keep your options open for some time in the future, this decentralizing trend would have to be arrested. To do so would involve taking the following sorts of steps that have obvious budgetary implications for the federal government. The growth cap on equalization would have to be removed so that it could continue to do the job that its formula intends it to do. The tax point component would have to be removed from the EPF calculation so that the cash component could grow at the rate of GDP growth without being ground down to zero automatically. Restrictions imposed on the rate of growth of EPF transfers would have to be removed or not used. The CAP program could be turned into a block grant to avoid adverse incentives from the matching formula. However, the national standards could be maintained and the cash transfer could be allowed to grow without a cap being imposed on it. While this would arrest the deterioration of the fiscal arrangements, in the longer term, joint federal-provincial efforts would have to be made to rationalize the system in light of what the system is intended to accomplish. Now, which of those two paths you would like to take depends upon your vision of what you want the Canadian Federation to look like sometime in the future. And this is obviously a matter of judgment. Some people would prefer that the federal government get out of the social policy area and the possibility for using the spending power. Other people would prefer that the federal government maintain an interest in establishing national standards. If they do, I would argue that the only policy instrument that's available to them is essentially the spending power. So it's a matter of judgment which of those you prefer, but I guess my point is that it would be a great shame if we let the choice be made by default, which is really the course that we've adopted so far. Thank you for your attention.
So we have time for some questions, if you'll raise your hand.
As governments are notoriously inefficient, we lose money at every exchange between the Fed and the provincial government. What do you think about the idea of voting for government, for area government, rather than provincial government or national government? It's been proposed by the Maritime.
The question is, given that governments are notoriously inefficient, why don't we have fewer of them by, instead of having 10 provinces, have something like 4 provinces? I don't have any strong objection in principle. I've spent a bit of time looking at attempts to do even modest forms of this in the Maritimes, and they've been notoriously unsuccessful. I didn't think of talking about that, partly because I didn't see a great point in talking about it, given the Constitution that we have today, but I certainly don't have any objection to it in principle, and I think that one could make a good case that some provinces are too small from the point of view of efficiently delivering public services. I don't think that would detract from the point I'm trying to make, that if you had 4 provinces rather than 10, I think the I think you still have to take this decision as to what role you see the federal government having in social policy rather than each of those four super provinces. The question is, if the federal, you accept my premise, and you think the federal government does, why is it that the federal government continues putting the squeeze on the provinces and makes it more difficult for the provinces to maintain, especially in the area of health services, the levels that we've come accustomed to? Is that more or less the? Well, I think my answer is that I don't think the federal government does accept my premise. There's no indication that the federal government does accept my premise. In fact, there's a lot of indication to the contrary that either they don't accept the premise or they haven't thought about it. Because a lot of the policy changes that have been made for fiscal reasons in the last 10 years, at least the last 10 years, have been moves which have essentially abrogated or reduced the ability of the federal government to achieve national standards in these areas. Yeah, although I mean, in citing those constitutional arguments, I wasn't suggesting that in any way the federal government was bound by what it says in the Constitution. I was simply using it to support my argument that there is a principle in the Constitution that provinces agreed to and that the federal government agreed to, which ought to guide policymakers in their decisions. There's nothing in, you know, even though the Constitution commits the federal government to doing something in principle, that kind of commitment is not something that could be enforced in the courts. So I was really using that to support the case that the major premise is one that should be taken seriously and to draw the consequences of it. But I mean, to repeat what I said, my sense is, and others may know better than that, my sense is that the federal government has basically taken the decision that for fiscal reasons, they're going to turn over these responsibilities to the provinces, and that's all there is to it. There's some doctors in the audience here. What is being suggested is that the success of the Medicare system has been because it is provincially based rather than federally based, and that if it were federally based, doctors would not be as supportive of the system because they would find it harder to deal with Ottawa than they would to deal with provinces. I'm not sure that what you're saying is in contradiction to the views that I put forward or that the previous commentator put forward. I think what I said was that there are very strong arguments for decentralizing the design and the delivery of these services, of which health is one of them. And included in those strong arguments are the kinds of things that you're suggesting, that that it's easier for provinces to administer these programs efficiently than it is for the federal government. The success of the program, though, I think I would argue, has partly to do with the federal participation in it since its inception. In two ways, really. Provinces, one reason why provinces are able to provide these, you know, roughly comparable services in Medicare and other social programs is because of the fact of the federal spending power enabling provinces to have the fiscal capacity to do that sort of thing. And also, this is a counterfactual argument that I don't know how you'd ever test, but the fact of the matter is that the conditions that are imposed by the federal government, the general conditions that are imposed by the federal government on the delivery of Medicare for the provinces, which are conditions that the provinces don't have to comply with. I mean, if they don't comply with them, they may lose some revenues, have been around since Medicare started in the 1960s, and have never been used. Now, there are different ways you can interpret the observation that they've never been used. You could say, well, they're very ineffective if they've never been used. The provinces have never been penalized for violating the criteria that says that medical care must be portable. I would argue the fact that they've never been used is an indication that they've been highly successful, and the federal government policy of setting these national standards has been highly successful in imposing these prospective penalties on them has been highly successful in getting the provinces to at least abide by a set of minimum national standards, which are not, you know, not really too intrusive.
Ooh.
I thought you were going to say the budget, and I would have answered it, but Quebec referendum. Professor Clark says he agrees with the major premise, but he wants to know what changes would one recommend in tax policy, bearing in mind the consequences for the upcoming referendum. I didn't say very much about tax policy, although tax policy in my mind is very much part of social policy. And the major premise that I had suggested would lead one to argue that the federal government ought to maintain enough of a role in the direct tax field to be able to maintain some form of national standards in redistributive tax policy. One of the things that's happened over the years is that the provinces have gained larger and larger shares of the tax room in the income tax field. And this is likely to occur even more in the future as the federal, you know, if the federal government starts to use the GST to get more of its revenue, it's going to end up turning over more of the direct tax room to the provinces. The consequence of that from the social policy point of view is simply that it's going to make the income tax system more fragmented, and the tax collection agreements are going to probably end up falling apart. I'm not sure what all this has to do with the Quebec referendum. The fact of the matter is that Quebec already has a separate income tax system. And it has a separate income tax system because it chose to have a separate income tax system, and also because, and this is, I think, fairly important, as part of the opting out arrangements that occurred when opting out was an option in the 1960s, the Quebec government, in turn for opting out, instead of getting cash from the federal government, got tax point transfers. The fact that they got tax point transfers meant, A, that they were able to establish their own income tax system and have a large amount of tax room to make it effective, and B, it's also meant that the cash component of the EPF transfer is falling. I don't have any particular objection to this form of asymmetric arrangement with Quebec. And I don't see any contradiction between the federal government maintaining enough income tax room in the rest of Canada to achieve harmonization there, and at the same time allow Quebec to have its own income tax system that it can use for its own purposes. To what extent are tax revenues declining due to reduced earning power and reduced fiscal control? Do you mean evasion? Is that the sort of thing you have in mind? Or, yeah. And what opportunities would there be for increasing tax revenue? Well, of course, tax revenues are increasing fairly rapidly. Tax revenues are increasing more rapidly enough to cause the cash component of EPF transfer to fall. I'm not sure to what extent you refer to reduced earning power. And it's certainly true that in periods where unemployment is high and earning power is low, then tax revenue goes up at a very low rate and transfers rise very rapidly, and that's one of the reasons why we have big deficits. I guess what you're really asking might be what scope is there for using tax increases to address the deficit as opposed to using expenditure reduction? Oh, you mean what can governments do to make sure that people pay their taxes? Don't. I haven't really thought about that very much, and I'm not sure that it is something which has great relevance for the social policy debate. Unless you, I see. Well, there certainly would be some scope for increasing the base of the GST, but people might not like very much if you started increasing the scope of the base of the GST, which is to basically include food in the GST. In terms of increasing the base of the income tax, sure. I mean, you can tax anything under the sun if you want. You could increase it to. I'm not exactly sure what you have in mind.
Well, I'm really thinking in terms of the changes that are taking place as a consequence of trade agreements, and wondering whether social policy would decrease in terms of
competitive. Oh, okay, I get your point. Well, it's certainly true that the fact of globalization has put a lot of pressure on governments to conform in certain areas of taxation, particularly in areas of taxation of capital. It becomes more and more difficult to extract high tax rates on capital when economies are very open and capital is able to flow freely back and forth. To some extent, it's difficult to impose high taxes on sales if there's cross-border shopping. But there's not enough mobility of people internationally, I don't think, to use arguments of free trade agreement and globalization as a basis for arguing that competitive forces are what would be keeping down, are what force you to keep down taxes on households, taxes on non-capital income. At least that's my point. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should increase taxes on people and increase taxes on consumption and so forth. But I guess all I'm saying is that I don't think that one could say that NAFTA, free trade with the U.S., globalization and increased competition in trade effectively deter you from imposing higher taxes on your residents on the one hand or providing greater social program to your residents on the other. I don't think the connection is that close.
Very bad.
Thank you.
I think I heard what you said. You agree with the initial premise, but you are unsure how Canada can maintain its social programs in the face of growing competitiveness and free trade with NAFTA. Is that the essence of the universalism of things like healthcare and so forth? Well, I can repeat just what I said earlier, and that is that I personally don't see a contradiction between free trade and goods and services on the one hand and taxing and providing services to your residents on the other. I don't see the contradiction, and I haven't seen very many economic arguments to suggest that free trade as such is likely to cause you to compete away social programs. If there were more, and the reason for that is that people are not very mobile internationally. There's more of a concern vis-a-vis the provinces because people can move freely across provinces, so there might be competitive forces at work between provinces to compete down the size of social programs. But I don't think it's the case necessarily that competition between countries should cause you to compete away social programs. Oh, like the Wall Street Journal, you mean that sort of thing? Well, in principle, there's no reason why the federal government can't legislate in this area. It may well be the case that certain decision makers in the economy don't like the kinds of decisions that certain governments undertake, but that's politics. I don't think there's anything inherent in the mobility of capital internationally or the existence of multinational corporations which would militate against national governments setting social policies the way they wish. I may be the naive one rather than you. Yeah, I should repeat your question, but I'm not sure that I can capture it all in a short phrase. You started out by saying that you thought the reason why the federal government collected more taxes in the provinces is because they had the more capacity to raise taxes originally. Yeah, well, okay, let me address the first question first, which says something like the following. I, are you, I?
Well, that's correct. Does the federal government have the right to do the greatest amount of taxing, and therefore they agree to give money to the province?
Right, well, let me answer that after I've said what the question is. The question is, I thought that when, this I'm talking on behalf of the questioner here, the questioner thought that the reason Medicare was initially financed by the federal government by turning over funds to the provinces was because the federal government had more ability to tax and the provinces had less, and therefore Medicare would not have been financed had the federal government not transferred revenues to the province. Let me deal with that question first, and then I'll come to the second one. In a sense, the answer is yes. I mean, what happens is that there's a major social program that you want to introduce that didn't exist there before. You've got 10 provinces in whose jurisdiction lies the responsibility for providing that program. In principle, if all of the 10 provinces got together and agreed among themselves, we're all going to raise our income taxes by, 10 percentage points to find the revenues to produce a medical care system that we all want, then the federal government need not intervene at all, and that would be a perfectly feasible way of doing it. But if each one of them is acting independently, one province comes along and says, I'd sure like to have Medicare in my province, but in order to have Medicare in my province, I'm going to have to increase my tax rates by 10% to provide Medicare to my residents, and if no other province does that, my tax rates are going to be a lot higher. People are not sure exactly what Medicare is going to be. They're going to move from Saskatchewan into Manitoba. The doctors are all going to get up in arms. They're going to go to other provinces. It's very difficult for an individual province to make a big tax increase like that on its own. So when the thing was first introduced, the federal government, acting sort of on behalf of the residents of all provinces, raised its taxes. And by making the transfers to the provinces matching or conditional on the provinces introducing a program, we're able to convince very quickly all provinces to go along with this. So I think in some sense your argument is right, that the provinces, constitutionally they had the taxing power, but individually they couldn't raise their taxes very quickly because of the adverse responses that this might have. And so there was a natural reason why the federal government might intervene to get these programs going. Now, in 1977, when the federal government changed its method of financing Medicare and post-secondary education, it was no coincidence that they referred to the act as the Established Programs Financing Act. By that time, the programs were established. The federal government could turn over the tax room to the provinces. The provinces then would all continue to operate these programs, and there would be no concern. Your second question, I think, was very similar to the one that was raised earlier, and it had to do with the fact that you disagreed with me about the difficulties of taxing in an international economy, and the reason was that there was no loyalty of capital owners, that they would take their money and go, and the people who had the money would go and move into Bermuda and so forth. And I don't disagree with you, and I think that I think I did say earlier on that the one thing that globalization and internationalization does do is it puts constraints on the ability of a country to tax capital income for the very reasons that you suggested, that capital has no loyalty and you don't have to have a passport to move your capital to another country where taxes are lower.
My point was that some money is loyal. Japanese money is loyal, isn't it?
Well, then maybe if Japanese money is loyal, they could get away with taxing it higher than we can get away with taxing our money, which isn't loyal.
We have time for two more questions. Gentleman at the door and the woman, you'll be next.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you haven't talked about a guaranteed annual income. Why haven't we seen some kind of a national guaranteed annual income and maybe to replace the capitalism or work in conjunction with it? And what's the possibility of doing something like negative income tax to sort of equalize the standards across the province? Or
Mm-hmm. Okay, the question is why did I not talk about guaranteed annual income or a negative income tax, so why couldn't the federal government implement programs such as that? And I guess the answer is twofold. One is that I decided I wouldn't talk about program design, but more jurisdictional issues. But that's not a serious answer to the question. A more serious answer to the question is, sure, I would be in favor of rationalizing the income support system that go to needy and low-income people. But the problem is that jurisdiction for that kind of thing lies largely at the provincial level. Jurisdiction for welfare programs lies at the provincial level. And therefore, in order for the federal government to have an influence over the way in which provinces reform their income, their welfare schemes, if they choose to do so, the only way the federal government can do that is by, you know, using some conditional grant scheme or some form of the spending power. Yeah. They can't introduce the programs themselves. No, that's a good question. The question is, how would the option number two impact upon British Columbia, essentially? If we say, okay, or at least how would the option two relative to option one impact on British Columbia? If we let the existing system run down, what would be the consequences for British Columbia relative to if we keep it in place? The consequences are very different for the three major programs, equalization, EPF, and CAP. It's true that British Columbia doesn't get any equalization, but it's also not exactly true to say that British Columbia pays money to the have-not provinces. I mean, the equalization system is a system which is financed entirely by the federal government. Now, it's certainly true that the revenues that the federal government gets to finance equalization, it gets by levying taxes all across the country. So you're paying taxes to the federal government, part of which they're using to pay monies to the have-not provinces. And certainly if the equalization system were allowed to meet its demise, then to that extent you would no longer have your tax burden in terms of financing federal government contributions to the have-not provinces would certainly decline. So to that extent you would be, if you want to look at it in these terms, you'd be better off by letting the system fall apart. But on the health one, though, it's a little trickier. There's nothing in the transfer scheme currently which takes into account the differential need that British Columbia might have for health costs arising from demographics, arising from the fact that it might have an older population. There's nothing in the scheme that does that. I mean, there are people who argue that the equalization scheme, if it's to be a proper equalization scheme, should take account of things like that. The CAP program is supposed to do that to some extent, not with regards to health, but with regards to welfare. If you're a province with high welfare loads, then the CAP system is a sort of an equalizing program. It provides you revenues to make it more easy for you to meet those obligations. But of course, in British Columbia, CAP has been capped. And so it's no longer, you know, whatever high caseloads you might have, they're no longer reflected fully in cap transfers. Under a block grant system, which is the option that is being talked about for cap, under a block grant system, the funding that each province would get would ideally be related to some measure of the need within that province, perhaps the number of welfare cases in the province or something like that. I don't know where BC stands vis-a-vis the other provinces in terms of welfare cases per capita, but if it was a high welfare case per capita province, then it might do rather well out of a block grant under cap.
Well, I'll ask Dr. Craig Riddell, the head of the Department of Economics, to thank our speaker.
Deadly. This is what Medicare is for, isn't it?
I've long been an admirer of Robin's scholarly work, and more relevant for this evening, of his ability to apply the results of academic research, which, as Robin indicated, is often quite abstract in nature, to important concerns of public policy. And that characteristic was evident in his lecture this evening, and in the related lecture which he gave on Thursday. As someone that has had some involvement in the recent debate over the reform of Canada's social programs, I found these lectures to be very thoughtful, very informative, and very well argued. So, Robin, on behalf of the Department of Economics, let me thank you for being our Woodward Lecturer for this year. And on behalf of the Vancouver Institute and the large audience here this evening, thank you for a lecture from which I'm sure many of us benefited.